Hello and welcome to One-on-One with LAPA, the Legislative Analysis and Public Policy Association's podcast series where experts discuss key issues and emerging topics in the areas of public health and safety, substance use disorders, and the criminal justice system. LAPA is funded by a grant from the Office of National Drug Control Policy, Executive Office of the President. Neither the Office of National Drug Control Policy nor any other federal instrumentality operate, control, or are responsible for or necessarily endorse this podcast. I am Stephanie Noblett, a legislative attorney with LAPA, and your host for today's podcast on overdose loss, grief, and resilience. According to the latest estimate by the CDC, just under 108,000 Americans died of a drug overdose in 2021. This breaks down to be roughly one U.S. overdose death every 5 minutes. With every overdose death, there are family and friends of the deceased who are left behind grieving the loss of their loved one. While grief is associated with all types of loss, the grieving process of an overdose death is unique because of the stigma surrounding drug use. By working to reduce this stigma, we can better support families and let them know that they are not alone. My guest today is Susan Kelly Stevens, an addiction expert and founder of the nonprofit organization Teal Drops, which she formed in memory of her daughter, Victoria. Teal Drops aims to reduce stigma through public awareness and education, family support, and relapse prevention. Susan has also conducted research on the types of grief related to overdose loss. So hello, Susan, and thank you for joining me today. We're really excited to have you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Stephanie.
Of course. So let's just jump right in. So can you tell me a little bit about yourself and the inspiration for the work that you do?
Yes. I was a commercial loan manager at a bank, and I was in a very bad car accident, broke my back and neck. And I was prescribed opioids, and I was getting long-term pain treatment for about 10 years, during which time my daughter took one of my pills to school when she was having extreme menstrual cramps. She had a diagnosed condition, and that pill led her to the principal's office. They called me because she had the pill at school that did not belong to her, and thinking in terms of the old adage about just scared straight, I decided to let them take her to jail thinking, okay, she'll never do something like this again and it will scare her straight and we'll never have to worry. That did not really happen. She was taken to jail and I will never forget them taking her in handcuffs to put her in the back of the car and her screaming and crying, "Mom, please, please don't let them do this to me. Mom, please don't. And she got in the back of the car and she was processed and was home in an hour. And I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be one really great thing that you know, we'll never have to worry about. And I had taught my children about drugs and raised them in as a single mother and really felt like I had done a good job. They went to church. They had high morals. They were loving, caring citizens and was really not aware of just how dangerous drugs are. My daughter was assigned a public defender who sexually assaulted her and she had PTSD as a result. She felt the injustice, but she also had the PTSD. So this hopeless, how can I take a pill to school, which was just for a stomach ache. And this person who did something so violent and tragic and hurt me so deeply and stole my innocence wasn't prosecuted in the same way or didn't face the same. So that was the first time she felt the stigma and the hatred. That stigma went on as she got help for the PTSD. The doctors, as she got addicted, more and more addicted, they kept prescribing more pills. They went from Xanax, pills to sleep, pills, and they kept increasing the dosage over time. and she was still having night terrors, and she was still having panic attacks, and she was shaking and having these terrible moments, just like when we were sitting on the couch talking. All of a sudden, she would just go into this terrible panic attack. And I didn't understand. And as she started self-medicating it, I called the doctor and I, you know, said, "You can't talk to me, but I can surely talk to you." Because she was 18, I wasn't allowed to be privy to what was going on behind closed doors in the doctor's office. But I was seeing what was happening at home and noticing that she, even though I was taking opioids, I was noticing more and more how this Ambien and the Xanax was stealing my child. And so I watched her go through the stages of addiction and not really knowing, but really judging. And I remember her coming to me one day and saying, "Mom, I'm not trying to kill myself. I'm not suicidal, but I just want to die." And I looked at her and I could see the pain. And I said, "Baby, I understand. I don't ever want to lose you, but I see the pain in your eyes, and I will be happy for you when God is ready for you." And she looked at me and ran over and squeezed me so hard. She said, "I didn't think you would understand." And I said, "Well, honey, how can I look in your eyes and not understand the pain I see? I know that you are not doing this intentionally. I know you're struggling, and I don't want to see you hurt." And I think about cancer victims, and when a cancer victim has cancer and they're really suffering and it's in that depth of the moment, we want them to have relief. We don't want to lose them, but we're ready for God to take them so that they don't have to suffer. And there came a point where I didn't want to lose my daughter, but I didn't want to see her suffer anymore. The last time I saw Toria, I saw her for the very last time on her birthday. She looked so bad. She had this like tick where her face was twitching. And I didn't know if it was withdrawal, if she was high and it was a result of whatever she had taken, or if she had overdosed so many times that it had been caused by brain damage. And I was assuming that it was probably the amount of overdoses and possibly the brain damage. And that birthday visit with her, it really affected me. I was getting on a cruise in the port of Miami, talking to her on the way as the cruise ship left the port of Miami. And we talked the entire way, and it was the most wonderful, lengthy, in-depth conversation about how much we loved each other and how proud I was. And she really wanted to get her life together. And she sounded so hopeful. And I'm leaving the cruise ship. And I thought, if I really want my child to do this, I have to do it too. And even though I have never used illegal drugs, I knew that I was physically dependent on the opioids. So I quit taking my prescriptions that day. Never took another one after that conversation. And I went through what is a physical withdrawal. So I put down my prescriptions and decided I'm not gonna take anything for my back. I had migraines, severe pain in my bones, in my joints, in my muscles, and I was shocked at how much pain. It was so much more than I experienced every day, and it made me realize this is withdrawal. And I had never realized how harsh withdrawal is. The year before, I had taken her on a cruise, and she actually broke her leg because she was afraid to take heroin on the cruise ship. She was afraid to go into Mexico with heroin or with a needle or with anything that could cause her to be arrested in another country. And she physically broke her leg. And I didn't even realize it until later. So getting this perspective, I realized that 7-8 months prior, when she broke her leg, that was why. This leads me to the following month, December, probably around the 17th or 18th, I got the first phone call from her. She never showed up for Christmas. She never picked up her gifts. She called me and said, "I was so angry at you. I had the worst Christmas ever, and I never wanted to speak to you again." And I said, "Toria, I texted your boyfriend. Your phone was disconnected. I couldn't reach out to you. I actually stayed home all day waiting for you with your gifts." And she didn't know. That was a very nice short call because we forgave each other, and I was hurt too. And we told each other we loved each other. And it was just so nice to have that forgiveness and that peace, because just a few days later, she died. I didn't know it at the time, but she had overdosed the day before on January 21st. And I found that out from the community paramedic. But I received a call on January 22nd at 3:41. When her boyfriend called me, he said, I thought it was her laughing. He was so distraught and so choked up that I thought it was my daughter, couldn't distinguish what between a laugh or a sob. And when he finally got himself together and said, "She's dead," I started asking questions. "Well, have you called 911? And he said, "They're here." I said, "Well, have they performed CPR?" He said, "They're done." And when he said, "The morgue's on their way," is when it really hit. And it was the most bizarre feeling of acceptance and of peace and of action. I immediately started comforting Zach as I grabbed my purse and went downstairs and got my son and said, "Let's go, Toria's dead." And then I started having to comfort him because he punched a door and screamed, "She's so selfish," which is another misconception of addiction, because in a way they're selfish, but in a way their brain's been hijacked, and it's not because they're selfish. They're distraught that they're destroying you and everything else, like a hurricane, that they're just destroying everything in its path, but it's not intentional. And he was so angry, which goes to the emotions that I studied in my master's program. But that feeling of anger when I was at acceptance, and the tears we shed were for the same person. So the uniqueness of each person's interaction with that person is also critical in my studies. So fast forward, we get there, and I said, I've got to go see her. And the lieutenant said, "Well, you know, you don't want to see her." And I said, "Yes, I do." And I didn't know that wasn't a thing. And I didn't know that you're not allowed to see your kid, and you're not allowed in the crime scene. So I very patiently and firmly stated that, "Oh, wait, you just finish your stuff, but I will see her before you pull her out of this house." Still didn't know I wasn't supposed to, but since he told me there's a ventilator in her mouth, you don't want to see her like this. I said, "That's okay. I've stood vigil beside her before 3 days at a time while she's overdosed in the coma. And, you know, I've lived this journey. That doesn't bother me. This is my child. I will look at her and hold her hand in any condition. There's blood on her. Well, that's okay. Well, she's naked on the floor. Put a sheet on her." It's, you know, there was nothing that he was going to do to persuade me that I was not going to kiss my child. And he said, "Well, you just don't want to see her like that, you know, on the floor." And I said, "That's exactly where I need to see her and how I need to see her, because I need to see her while her spirit is still in that room. I have things I need to say to her." And I didn't know what those things were. They just came out when I got there. But I kissed her and I said, "I'm so proud of you." And that sounds so bizarre, but I was proud. She went to NA meetings. She had periods and bouts of recovery. She got jobs and was successful and managing her mental health, which those pills blew her up and made her fat. And she struggled with the obesity caused by the medications. And she struggled with the PTSD and the night terrors and all the mental health co-occurring disorders that everyone in addiction has, whether they have it to begin with, the chicken or the egg, or they get it later, they all end up with coexisting disorders. You can't separate mental health from addiction. So I was so proud of her. And so kissing her and telling her how proud I was, I meant that with every fiber of my being. And the next thing I said is, I'm so happy for you. Your kid's laying dead from sticking a needle in her arm. And I was so happy for her because she never had to have another panic attack. She never had to have another night terror. This child never had to live through another moment of withdrawal. She never had to suffer with the nausea and the diarrhea and the muscle aches and not being able to get to the bathroom or not being able to take a shower even. All the things that come with addiction, and she never had to deal with that ever again. So like a cancer patient, I was so happy for her. Those two things just, they felt so purely perfect when I said them. But the next thing, you won't die in vain? What the heck does that mean? I was about to go back to law school. I wanted to be a lawyer. My dream, I had a bachelor's degree in criminal justice and correction. My dream was to go on to law school, and I had actually just taken the LSAT and was ready to start law school or in the credentialing phase, wanted to get into Wake Forest. So telling her you won't die in vain made no sense, but it just came flowing out and I had no idea, you know, that was going to be my mission, that she was going to be my mission, that this was the next phase of my life was going to be that she didn't die in vain. And I started doing crazy things. That Fox 8 was in my house the next morning, doing an interview. You did not die in vain, baby. A local mother loses her daughter to overdose and hopes to save lives. I'm saying that the next day. I went to a heroin walk within a month. The Clemens Courier was writing articles about an opioid tragedy that Toria was a West Forsyth grad. She was academically gifted and a pillar of this community. Everything that she did, they were listing out the trophies she had won, being in the Mustang Mavericks and the volleyball manager and the cheerleader and just every reason that this is not going to be the kid that dies, but those are the kids that are dying. It is the kid next door. It is the high achiever. It is the one that you would never believe. In my studies, I found that addiction, we grieve in silence. And we're grieving long before they die. We're grieving from the get-go. As soon as they start making the poor choices, we grieve the loss of the jobs. We grieve the suspension at school if they're young, or the loss of relationships. Everything that's in that hurricane's path of destruction, we grieve all of it. We grieve the hopes and the dreams that we had for them.
Thank you so much for sharing that story. I mean, it's such a impactful and profound story. And I think in a way that I have never felt before in just reading, you know, something out of Time Magazine or the New York Times, or even seeing something on the local news, to hear it come out of your mouth and experience it kind of almost alongside you just really shows how physically and mentally demanding addiction and trauma is on not only the victim, but also the family around them. And I'm so sorry for your loss. But when you said you didn't understand why you had said your death won't be in vain, it's almost like she had whispered that to you and before you even realized. And, you know, I think it's amazing that you were able to kind of do so much in honor for your daughter and now saving so many other lives and having such a big impact. So part of the work that you've done in the aftermath of all this is you starting your organization, Teal Drops. So can you tell listeners a little bit about what the mission of Teal Drops is and what kind of work the organization does?
So I shared with you that I went to the End Heroin Walk and I met a congressman at the End Heroin Walk 1 month and 2 days after her death. And I handed him the newspaper article that had come out 2 days before. I said, read this on the plane. I want you to know I lost my kid a month ago. And he was like, wow. He said, you need to go to DC and meet with the head of the opioid task force. He hand wrote Pete Sessions, Washington, DC, and his phone number and everything. Hand wrote this for me on a little scrap piece of paper. And I took this home. And when I got home, I called the writer from that article and she said, oh, by the way, I wrote a book and I'm kicking it off in DC in a couple weeks and I need you there because I'm going to give part of the proceeds to Teal Drops. I had already decided to do Teal Drops. So Teal Drops is a nonprofit that 501c3. June 6th, D-Day, ironically, was the day that was stamped by the U.S. Treasury in 2018, just a few months after she died. And I went to D.C. not having it actually officially be a nonprofit yet. I'd only filed the paperwork with the state, but we were still waiting for that to come back. And I started meeting with Congress. Different House reps, Virginia Fox and Congressman Sessions, and they all just welcomed me in. And it's both sides of the spectrum. This is not a political thing. I didn't know what the focus of Teal Drops was going to be because I just wanted to save the world. So Teal Drops started as awareness. We all have tears. The teal tear is the symbol of the opioid epidemic because teal is a color of spring, fresh, new life, coming out of addiction, saving lives, giving hope, creating compassion. So the teal stands for just something fresh and vibrant and new and saving lives. The silver lining on that tear was that through all the deaths we've had, that if we can come together, we can save the next life and save lives going forward. So hopefully it would be an awareness campaign. My research at Wake Forest shows that we grieve in silos and in silence and in shadows when there's someone that we love that's addicted. We start grieving long before they die, and even after they're gone, we continue to grieve in silos and in silence and in shadows. That has to change in order for the families to heal. The normal stages of grief, denial, bargaining, anger, depression, acceptance that everybody knows about, there's the additional stages when it comes to addiction, grief, and overdose loss. We have the shame, the blame, and the guilt. Because sometimes we've pushed them away because we didn't want to go down with the ship. We distance ourselves because they were taking too much of an emotional, physical, or financial toll on us that we had to create a safe space. So there's so much guilt that we maybe, if we hadn't done that, we could have saved them. And I tried to share, part of Teal Drops' mission is to share that these are all normal feelings. The guilt, shame of the addiction, shame of the way we treated them, possibly because of our anger or our disappointments, because they weren't living the way we wanted them to live or the way we taught them to live or the way we wanted, you know, what we had expected for them. And, you know, we blame them. We blame ourselves. We blame each other. And all these additional is compounding. And if we stay in the shadows and we don't come out, then we can't heal. So some of my research showed that when people grieve together, whether it's family unity, friends, people in the community, if they come together, they heal exponentially faster. So my goal with Teardrops is sort of like Susan G. Komen. When she died, her sister Nancy Brinker started this race and handed out the pink ribbon. By doing that, everyone left with the pink ribbon, and it became a phenomenon that whether you love someone, you know someone, you are someone that had breast cancer, you relate. So when you see that pink anywhere, that visual pink, you know there's no judgment. There's a compassion and a unity and almost like a, yeah, me too. I can feel you and sympathize with you, or I can care about you. So it almost puts a warm smile in your heart. So my goal was to make that tear, we all have them, and make that part of our unity. So if that teal tear could become this international sign of the opioid epidemic, that I am someone, I know someone, or I love someone with addiction or overdose loss, then we have a united front that I see you, I can hug you, you're a total stranger. You see people at the races with pink shirts on and you hug them. You see somebody in the with a breast cancer shirt and you immediately say, oh, I lost my mom, or yes, I'm a survivor. So those are the survivors, and we need to promote the survivors of addiction, the survivor of the co-occurring disorders of the mental health issues. Having something to rally around together helps not just the person suffering from addiction, but every single person that hurricane is destroying. It helps them have hope for rebuilding. That is the initial mission of Teardrops, was to unite this world of the compassion that teal tear is something you can stand behind in unity. And you don't have to suffer in silence and shadows anymore.
That's wonderful. I love that creating this sense of community among survivors and the loved ones of individuals who have died of overdose is a central mission of Teardrops. Reducing the shame and the blame is just so important to the healing process. And you're right, losing someone to overdose should be no different from losing a loved one to cancer or any other chronic disease. People shouldn't have to grieve alone. So what other things is Teardrops currently working on that you can share with us?
We come out of COVID, I graduate, and now I'm ready to really do something with Teardrops. I had created a coloring book when she first died using her artwork. I had met with someone and he agreed to do the coloring book artwork, the graphic artist with her bulldog, and he wasn't going to charge me. He was doing this as a loving gift and a gesture. And so I took the pledge items on my website and in my brochure that I won't use somebody else's drugs and I'll take back my scripts and I'll lock my meds. And I took all those and I made them rhyme for a younger introductory version to young children. And when this coloring book finally went to print in December of last year, 2021, I finally went to print with it after COVID and we started coming out. I ordered a drawstring bag. We got several toys to put in this, all prevention related. And we approached the Forsyth County Sheriff, where she passed away, and asked him if we could Teardrops put these prevention kits in the car as a donation. We would like your officers, when they go to an overdose call or they go to a home where there's drugs or there's an arrest or there's domestic violence and you know drugs are in the middle of it, if we could give these to the children to kind of take their mind off of it, but also as a first introductory learning experience. And we approached the sheriff and he loved the idea. He called five of his friend sheriffs and they all said, yes, what a wonderful idea. We'd like to do that. Well, we are putting 1,000 in three different sheriff's departments. So it took a little bit to put these together, but they are rolling out. So we have in our prevention kit, we have our teal drops, coloring book. All of these have cute little puppy dog tank. Toria named her bulldog tank. And so this is just an introductory, but in this bag, there's a brochure. And the brochure has our pledge, it has our story, it has Toria's story, and it also has what I've done to bring teal drops forward and how I'm trying to educate people that addiction knows no bounds. It's not now or never has it ever been an ethnic or racial phenomenon, nor is it constrained by socioeconomic status or education level. And in this brochure, this is really for the parents, but it talks about what opioids are and the opioid crisis, what constitutes abuse, and even signs of withdrawal and stuff. So that's educational. But then the children get a teal drops little bracelet and a crayon wheel that says prevent opioid misuse. We were so lucky to find a mood tier that has like a kind of a stress face, and it says prevent opioid misuse on the back. So, you know, they can squeeze and hold in this cute little face. It's my favorite thing in the whole thing. And then we put a stuffed bulldog, and Toria painted the bulldog. So our bulldog is our little mascot. Eventually, we're hoping to have bulldog costumes that the characters can go into the schools. And it all comes in this making the teal tier, the opioid epidemic icon for loving someone, being someone, or knowing someone in addiction, or just supporting our cause with compassion, because the tier is compassion. But it says prevent opioid misuse. So this is our latest thing. It's not where we're going to stop because of my counseling background. We want to do counseling. I even do telephone counseling. The telehealth has become a wonderful, wonderful tool because people can get on their cell phone, even if they're homeless. A lot of homeless people still have a cell phone. Not all. We want to launch some apps and different things that we have in the works. We're making our coloring book bilingual. I have someone working on a Hispanic version, and I'm very, very pleased with that because I really just like the pink ribbons in every, you know, the Susan G. Komen's in every country. They have walks and runs and things. This is not about me. It started with Toria, but this is about every person who has tears, and that's all of us. And that compassion. This tear emits compassion and rallying around something that's tangible that we can all come together. And that color and that tear, that Tiffany blue color, is so hopeful. And so this is our first phase.
Congratulations on all of you've accomplished just in that short amount of time. It's very impressive. And I love the idea of the bags and the coloring book with Tank. I think it's extra special that Tank was out of Victoria or Toria's creation. I think that makes it really unique and ties it all back to her. And I think it's great that it's able to provide just a little bit of comfort to kids in a time of high stress.
It also sounds like you have some great project ideas coming up in the future, and I can't wait to see what the future holds for Teal Drops. I think this organization is going to do a lot of good. So you had mentioned a little bit about your research already in the interview, but can you talk a little bit more in depth about what you studied?
I went back to school, got a master's at Wake Forest in a dual program, addiction research and clinical health. I took both tracks. I did the research piece and I did the clinical piece where I am a licensed clinical addiction -A. I'm a baby LCAS until I complete my 2000 hours and my first 2000 hours. Then I can test and become a licensed clinical addiction specialist on my own. The research I did, I researched addiction. I researched all aspects of addiction, but I did my capstone on overdose loss, grief, and resilience. And the reason I did that is because I felt like I was resilient day one. I was on a panel with several other people for Wake Forest before I even, that's how I learned about their program, actually, that I ended up getting my master's in. But I was on this as a family expert on addiction. And the gentleman next to me said, wow, I lost my kid 5 years ago, and I'm still not where you are in acceptance. I attribute part of that to having that 3.5 years from rape to death as a 3.5 year education on what it's like to be the hurricane hunter, traveling through her hurricane, traveling through her storm, gathering the data. In some ways, I did experience some of it. So I'm on that plane, I hit the turbulence, you know, and I had my own opioids that I was taking. So I was able to understand. I think God had that in my lap for a reason, that I was able to understand some of the withdrawal, not all of it, because, you know, my brain, for whatever reason, didn't become addicted like hers did. And I believe part of that is the co-occurring disorder that sometimes it feeds the need. And what she needed fed was that hurt, that trauma, and that PTSD that she couldn't face alone, and she needed to numb that. So there was an additional element over and above the addiction.
You spent a lot of time in your research talking about the different types of grief, which I think a lot of people don't realize that there's multiple ways in which people grieve or that grief manifests. Can you talk a little bit about those?
The normal grief, complex grief, ambiguous grief, and disenfranchised grief were what I touched on. And in my research, complex grief is like from overdose loss, suicide loss, even COVID loss. And what complex grief means is that there's a social stigma or a moral stigma, feelings of helplessness, and what I touched on before, the guilt, shame, and blame. And that's what makes, you know, an overdose loss so much more complicated and so much more the reason why we need something that we can kind of rally around or that we can identify others in the community. That means you don't have the stigma. If you're wearing a shirt, you obviously are saying, hey, it can happen to me, it can happen to you. And then I touched on ambiguous grief, and that's grief before the loss. That's that there's a traumatic loss even before they die. The loss of all the hopes and dreams and the things that you had planned for your child or they had planned for themselves, or maybe it's even a spouse. It doesn't have to be a child. So that in ambiguous grief, it immobilizes the family processes. You know, there's the guilt and blaming each other, and two people that love the same person might grieve differently, like a husband and a wife, or like myself in acceptance and my son in anger. There's so much that's the same, but there's so much that's unique. And that's predicated on what your relationship was. And was your relationship at a good place at the moment of their death? So there's so many variables that nothing, it's as unique as our DNA. It blocks coping, it blocks decision-making, freezes the grief. When you have ambiguous grief, sometimes, you know, you're not able to grieve. You have to, you know, put on this face and just try to get through the storm. You really can't deal with what you're going through when you're trying to save your loved one's life. So all of that ambiguous grief is so traumatic long before they die. And you go back to that saying where you put your life mask on first. I had to kick Toria out because I couldn't let her destroy me too, or her brother too, who was still in high school. So there's a lot of moving parts to it. But the big thing is that when it's an overdose or suicide, there's disenfranchised grief. Because either whether you portray it on yourself or society portrays it on you, there's feelings of not being worthy, not just the person in addiction, but the people around them, they try to distance themselves. I've seen very powerful, very wealthy, very successful people distance themselves from their loved one because it's almost like they're scared that the stigma is going to be tied to them. I did the same thing. It's very human when you're a good decision maker and you have your life together and you're very successful that you don't want to be tainted by being that person that raised this person or that is related to this person. You want to disassociate. And that part of that is because they feel like it's a moral failure, where it is not a moral failure. And that's where we need to educate. This is nothing to do with choice. There's a brain disease. There are changes to the brains. Each person is a little different in our genetic makeup. So some people might try a drug right next to the next person who never has to do it again. And that person may never be able to stop again. But disenfranchised grief, going back to not being worthy, not being acknowledged, judged, they hide from society and their shame. I talk about not having casseroles, because when someone has cancer, everybody's bringing casseroles. And there's no casseroles when your kid dies from overdose. There's nobody coming and rallying around you saying, oh, I'm so sorry. They're ashamed to look at you. They don't know what to say. And personally, I think a lot of parents feel this way, at least if they're accepting and know that it's not a moral failing, because many parents feel like it is too, and they judge their own kids. But if they know the difference, then they want you to say their kid's name. They want you to come and tell a story that they've never heard about, something funny or something sweet. Every one of the people dying of addiction has these stories. My daughter's not unique. Every person who has addiction or has died of an overdose has these touching stories. And if we got to know who they were, they died being that person. The addiction just kind of hid it from us.
Your research that you did is so important because it's so clear that there's a difference between the types of grief or how loved ones are even allowed to grieve for the loss of a child, a parent, a friend of an overdose as compared to somebody with cancer or some other chronic disease. And, you know, it shouldn't be that way. And I think a lot of the times the addiction just overtakes the memory of the person. And like you said, there's so much more to Toria and everyone else out there that struggles than just their addiction. That's such a small part in the grand scheme of things of who they are. And I hope that the work that you're doing with Teal Drops to address stigma can kind of break down some of that and allow for families to grieve like they would in any other case. And I think being able to do so would really help in the healing process as well. So I have one final question for you. What kind of policies are needed to support families that have dealt with an overdose loss? Like, what would you like policymakers and lawmakers to know?
Actually, I love that you asked this question, but I have to go bigger. What I want to see is the support network to begin with the addiction, not with the overdose loss. Even when you said that, was like, it doesn't start there. It doesn't. Our research shows the ambiguous grief starts when we find out our loved one is suffering, or when we first have that first phone call, whether it's an arrest or a DUI or a pill at school or whatever it is. The support network needs to start at the beginning. It needs to start when we first find out. One of my board members wants to help put some brochures together. What next? I found out my kid used. What next? Or I lost someone. What next? Like, where do I go? So resources to help from the very beginning. People are blindsided, especially if they're happy, healthy, successful family with good jobs and good lifestyles and make proper decisions. And they get to this point where they're just blindsided by this. So I would like help from the onset. And maybe even before that, with my education piece, that's the introductory. That's to start the conversation. We are now working on the activity book with research-proven, age-appropriate middle school activities in this activity book that would educate, but not like past programs where they just shine a light on it or make it, oh, well, this makes you feel happy and this makes you feel down. And you know, but more stages of addiction and how it evolves, how the innocence turns into, you just stepped into a rip current that is going to suck you away and you're oblivious to it. So get there before and teach about the rip current ahead of time. So that's our next phase, is doing the middle school version, the next step in education, but making it engaging so that some of these tools can be used in the household, because parents don't want to talk about it. Like, I just threatened my kids. I said, you ever do this, I'll never speak to you again. Well, you see, that didn't work. And so many parents do that. And I judge the other kids. Oh, don't talk to them. They use drugs. Well, that became my kid that nobody wanted to talk to. Legislators, when we talk about why would I want to spend $1 million on this? We know the hurricanes are coming. We know the weather. There's no doubt that it's coming. So when you look at why it's good to spend $1 million on an airplane that's going to fly into a storm, a perfectly good airplane flying into the storm, collecting data on the hurricane, why would we do that? Well, we're doing that because that could save us $10 million when we can narrow down where the storm's going to hit and how it's going to hit and how it's going to affect the communities around it, and that we can be there with FEMA. So my FEMA is Families, Eulogies, Morgues, and the Aftermath, so that FEMA can come in and get the help that we need. And what you're talking about is the FEMA part of that. How do we get the help that we need for them? But even better, if we can predict how the storm's going to hit, where it's going to hit, all those prevention tools, we need the studies for that, but we need the support networks. Statistics said that 14 to 18 year olds doubled in overdose deaths, not because more are using, because that statistic actually dropped. It's because there's fentanyl and fake pills and fake powders. Children don't understand the dangers. And if 12 to 14 year olds are doubling in overdose deaths, we need to hit before 12. From 9 to 12 is where we need to educate.
That's an excellent point. I think you're 100% right that by the time the overdose happens, it's too late. So I think prevention really is key, especially with like counterfeit pills and things being adulterated with fentanyl. Thank you so much for being willing to do this for us. I'm honestly just in awe of your story and the work that you do, and know that it's not easy work. It definitely takes a toll, but the passion that you have for it, I think, is really what sets you apart. And of course, I wish you best of luck and everything. And so thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me, and thank you for sharing your platform. If we can help one mother to feel a little bit less guilty or a little bit more healed, share that they're not alone, that if there was 108,000 overdose deaths or a little less, then there's 108,000 moms out there. 108,000 mothers in 1 year. I mean, it's millions, but if you think about the world and you think about the last 10 years, there's a ton of moms out there that are suffering. They're suffering in silos and in grief and alone and in shame. And that shouldn't be. We should be standing proud. We need to highlight, if you have a card that your loved one gave you when they were 10 and the sweet message about you're the best mom in the world, you are that person. That 10-year-old never goes away. That 10-year-old died with that heart and that feeling and that love. They just were hurting. And this is a hurt disease, and it hurts everybody in its path. this is a national crisis that touches every single one of us. There's not one person that doesn't have one degree of separation. They know someone, they are someone, or they love someone that's addicted.
Thank you again. Parents and friends are really survivors and champions as well. It's important that we remember them in the aftermath of everything.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you to Susan Kelly Stevens for joining us today. If you are interested in learning more about Teal Drops and the resources it offers, please visit tealdrops.org. Please join us for the next one-on-one with LAPA, where we will discuss another interesting topic.